Welcome to the First Customers Podcast. Today we have Dominic Rubino with us. He has bootstrapped a business from zero to $120 million in sales in only 4 years. And he's also grown a franchise from six franchisees to over 200 around the world. So he's a perfect guest for the First Customers Podcast as we're trying to learn all the different ways different entrepreneurs got their first customers. So Dominic, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for making time for us. How did you get those very first customers?
You know, I was thinking about that as you were doing the intro bit there. I always feel like I'm getting my next first customer. I don't think the joy of it ever goes away. You can tell. So I come at business ownership through sales. You know, some people come through a technical background. They are an engineer, an accountant, a lawyer. I didn't have that. I was in university for a long time. Never became a doctor. I was always a C student. So I was always kind of hustling. I remember back in school, for a fundraiser, we had to sell licorice all sorts from door to door. You know, those little square licorice things. And so the teacher gave us all boxes on, I can't remember the day, but just say a Friday. And then Monday we came back and she's like, you know, who sold theirs? And I sold all mine. I can take more. I know the other kids hadn't done any. I just knocked on doors and sold them. And so that would be the first time. But then, you know, I started a company. I installed Christmas lights.
Okay.
And now I live in the Pacific Northwest. So you got to imagine, I'm a grade 12 kid. I've got a Toyota pickup and my dad's ladder and a staple gun. And I'm installing electrical on cedar shake roofs in the rain. I don't even know how I'm alive anymore, but that's how I started the trade. Yeah.
That's a nice, simple business though. Pretty straightforward.
Yeah. And what's funny is it's come around again. A lot of companies are installing Christmas lights now. It's a thing. It's a great add-on if you do landscaping or even painters, obviously, and home services of all sorts, which I deal with every day in my trade. So it's nice because it's full circle, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So what about the company that started from zero and went to 120 million. Tell us about that company and how you got those first customers.
Yeah. So kind of a crazy story. Cause when I say it started from zero, it started from less than zero. It was a Excel spreadsheet that I was putting together and I was in partnership with my cousin, which I will never do again. We're still cousins, but family business is not my thing. Anyways, we were selling used junk on eBay and you got to keep in mind, I'm old. I was selling stuff on eBay when eBay was brand new. And so what we were selling was used LED calculators, ColecoVision, Atari, Intellivision games and systems, stuff we would buy at garage sales and flea markets and then resell on eBay. And we stumbled across this little, you can call it a niche or a niche, as some people say it, where we started to sell over-the-counter medications like skin whitening cream and the sort of things that aspirin. What we didn't know is that, because I live in Canada, things in Canada are cheaper than in the States, medication-wise. If a bottle of 80 aspirin here costs $24, I'm just making that number up, in the States, you got to get a prescription and then you're going to pay $80 for it. So people bought from us for that reason. Anyways, I scaled that business because I knew how to script our call center. Scripting was very, very important. Actually, I've got some funny stories for you on that. And we were able to take a regular transaction and when somebody called us for a pricing thing and then turn it into a longer transaction because they had a prescription. And a prescription is a pre-purchase order for at least three other refills. Now I've got you. I can add value three other times and upsell you on things that are not medication. So that's how we did it.
Okay. So talk a little bit about that call center script.
Well, so I'm going to tell you the funny story because, you know, it was a 120 seat call center. It didn't start that way though, Paris, not at all. It started as we had a website, as you always do, right? Mm-hmm. I know you're a website expert. So we had a website and I had come from telecom. So I actually learned professional sales. I tried to be a realtor for a while. I did okay, but I didn't like it being a real estate agent. And then I got recruited to work for Sprint. And when I say Sprint, I mean Sprint head office, blue suit, white shirt, red tie. We were basically trained like gladiators. We were in a bullpen, cubicles. Everybody was fight all day long type sales. And actually, I loved it. It was just really a frat house. That's all it was, right? Contests and high fives and a lot of testosterone in the room.
Yeah.
But you had to run every single day. And I learned a lot there. But the other thing I learned when I was there is how to deal with call centers. So when we started growing this business, I thought, well, let's get a 1-800 number. How can that hurt? And so what happened is our phone started ringing. And as soon as we hung up one call, we'd get on with the next person and they would say, I've been on hold for 10 minutes. And I thought, well, that's weird. So we made the huge investment, Paris. We called in the phone company, which took, 3 weeks, 4 weeks to get there. And they put in a 4-line overline. You got to remember, this was years ago, right? And so the little red buttons that light up on the phone.
Yeah.
So the technician goes and he plugs in and he goes, hey, Dom, come on over here. Let's have a look. And he does his little programming. And then all the lights lit up. And he's like, oh, sorry, let me check something there. Da-da-da-da. All the lights are lit up. He goes, what's going on here? I'm like, I don't know. So we started answering the phone. We couldn't keep up. We started with a girl that we had hired as our administrator, said, do you want to start taking calls? She did. My partner did. I did. And then I was at the point where I was hiring 10 people a week.
That's crazy.
And so it grew. So
how are they finding out about you? Like, what was the call? That huge influence. Okay. So was it an SEO tray where you were just getting tons of rankings?
You're talking about the early days of. So mail order pharmacy. Sorry. So we recreated from at one point, I've skipped big chunks of the story. I didn't go from installing Christmas lights to that.
Right.
I went from installing Christmas lights to trying to be a realtor. Didn't like being a realtor. Got recruited to Sprint corporate. Right. Mm-hmm. So I was selling business accounts. Then I went and sold money for a while. I sold leasing. That's funny on its own because
what is that? So, leasing?
So you sell money. So if somebody's going to buy a forklift. Okay. Or a piece of heavy capital equipment, maybe a baler, a crusher, forklift, backhoe. You want to be able to cash flow that. So it's called off balance sheet lending. So leasing a piece of equipment like a CNC or just some equipment that you need for your company, you can pay for it or you can get bank financing or there's third party companies, leasing companies that will allow you to lease that over 36 months. And at the end of the term, you either buy it out for the remaining, let's just say $30,000, or you pay it down to zero. So it's a way to cash flow your business.
Hmm.
But you want to hear the funny part of that?
Sure.
Sure. So the company I worked for was called Copelco, which sounds a little bit Italian because it ends in an O, but it was actually a Dutch bank called De Lage Landen. And this bank is so old, they used to finance the spice trade, like with wooden ships and Dutch guys, with contracts that were like old style stuff. Anyways, you dial it forward into where we are today, and they're the leasing arm's called Copelco. Hmm. Well, my name's Dominic Rubino. So I would call a guy, say, hey, Paris, it's Dominic calling. I'm from Copelco. I understand you're trying to buy a forklift or a piece of heavy equipment. And you go, yeah. I go, well, I'm here to help you, find a way to finance that. So it sounds like a normal conversation, but every once in a while, I get a guy on the phone who would say, hang on a second. You're telling me the bank turned me down for financing? Yeah. You tell me you can get me that equipment. Yeah. But I got to deal with Dominic Rubino from Copelco who says he can get me money because do you understand why I feel a little nervous here? And so I would always play it up, right? I would always play it up. I'm like, we're going to meet at a Starbucks. You'll recognize me. I got no neck and one eyebrow. And they would laugh. But so I sold money. So I've had a sales background all throughout.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm going to get down into the details here of this kind of some of the tactics. So what about your website was causing all those phone calls to come in?
So I can tell you the website, although the company's been sold a number of times, and the website just describes what it is. It's called CanadaPharmacy.com.
Okay.
So if you wanted to buy medications from Canada and you're in the States, and this is still a note for everybody out there. If you're in the US, you can buy medications from Canada as long as you go to a certified Canadian pharmacy, and you're going to save a ton. Reason is simple. Our economic climate is just different. Our politics.
Right. Doesn't the Canadian taxes subsidize some of it?
Healthcare in Canada is subsidized. So here's the high level. Let's use aspirin again as a dumb example, right?
All right.
Our government says, oh my God, everybody needs aspirin. We have to make it affordable.
Yeah. Right?
Now, the sales reps at the corporate level go to the American government and say, hey, we got this medicine. It's called aspirin. And they say it's very important. And the American government goes, it's important. People will pay what it's worth, right? And those guys go, yeah. So that's how you get that price difference. So it actually falls under medical tourism, believe it or not. And anybody who lives like in the Detroit area is nodding their head now because they already go up to Toronto and buy their medications anyway. Us loads of people do it. So we just turned that into an online thing, and that's where the phone number was.
Okay. So people were already looking for this, and you guys
an appetite for
showed
it.
Up. Okay.
Yeah, it's the same as somebody going to Mexico to buy medications, but that's a that's a little different. Canada's got a different brand.
Yeah, feels less risky for sure.
Feels less risky.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's and it's legit. By the way, it is legit. It's the same medication that you buy. It comes out of the same factory.
And I guess that's because after a certain amount of time, like whatever patents on the specific chemicals or whatever are done, and so anybody can make a generic version of a
generics count as well. But you know, I mean, the reality is Canada is like a tenth of the size of the United States. So they're not going to throw a factory in Winnipeg to make aspirin. They're just not going to do it. Or heart medications. It gets done out of a central location and then it gets shipped to other locations. Well, they ship it to New Zealand. Those people have the same blood as us.
Mm-hmm.
They ship it to Asia. They ship it everywhere in the world out of one location. Maybe a couple of locations, but it's not a different medication. It's the same stuff.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the one that grew from zero to 120 million over 4 years. That's after, granted, you had a career in sales in different ways. And so you were able to kind of take everything you'd learned and put it into this business to grow it relatively quickly. It.
Yeah. And, you know, I looked at the data. You want to hear a funny story about growing that company?
Sure.
So I'm looking at reports from the call center. Who's buying our stuff, right? And so I've got a report, just a bunch of different reports. Who bought pet medications from us? Who bought allergy medications? Who bought birth control? They're all just different lists to me, right? My cousin comes in. He goes, "Hey, Dom, you want to go for lunch?" I'm like, "Sounds like a plan." So I take the sheets that are in my hand. I just drop them on the table. Out we go for lunch. Well, I come back and I sit at my desk and I'm like, "Hey, the list of people who buy pet medications from us a lot fell over top of the list of people who bought birth control from us a lot." And I'm like, huh, how do I script this so that when somebody calls us to buy pet medications, we say, without offending them, "Hey, you might want to buy some birth control." And really what we did was something very simple. If you called in to buy pet medications, the actual script that our agent used was to say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I missed what you said. Was that a dog barking in the background?" And then somebody would say, "No, my cat just knocked something over." Okay. Did you know that we sell pet medications? No, I didn't. Interesting. And off we go.
Nice.
Yeah. And then so scripting the other way too. But you gotta think about the customer's needs at all times.
Right. Can you get a little deeper into script writing? Because I don't think we've had someone talk at length or give like really specifics on kind of that art of writing sales scripts, because I know that's really important, especially if you're trying to scale a team and have some tight processes and everything. So we'd love to hear kind of some insights or lessons learned about sales scripts.
Yeah. I would think, or I do think, the hardest part of script writing is not the script writing. It's training the people on the phone to sound natural.
Okay.
And you know who does a good job of that is when you call Apple support. They do a very good job of sounding natural. And that comes from really high confidence training. So when I do script writing or sales process formatting, like figuring out what our sales process is going to be, it starts with what I said a second ago. The customer and the customer's needs and how they feel and what they're trying to solve is the only thing that matters. And so everything has to come back to that. So if I'm reading from a script and it says, "Thank you for buying our hand lotion. We, appreciate your business. Have you thought about our foot cream? It's on sale now." Well, nobody's going to buy that.
Yeah.
They're not. It sounds horrible. So I have to teach my people to be natural, to be friendly. And really sales, we can overcomplicate sales all we want. We haven't talked about this, but I was a business partner with Brian Tracy, who's a very well-known sales and sales management guru, granted from the 80s and 90s, but sales is sales. It hasn't changed for years. But you got to make it conversational. You have to develop rapport and you have to make it sound smooth because nobody wants stilted conversation.
So do you hold like, one-on-one, like quality testing, like training sessions where it's like acting out and making sure that they sound natural and that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, the biggest mistake that I see is that people do product training and they think it's sales training. Sales training is sales training. If you learn the process of selling, of having curiosity and caring, you can sell anything. As long as you're curious about the other person and you care. Now, it just so happens that my solution might be hand cream, foot cream, skin whitening cream, whatever the product or service we're selling is, right? But I have to be really curious and find out about that person and then solve a problem. If I just say, oh, our skin cream has this much zinc and this much aloe and all the technical specs, you're only going to sell to scientists.
Right.
And how many scientists a day are calling you, right? You need to find out why. Why do you need skin cream at all? Can't you just use the soap at your sink? Oh my God, no, it dries my skin out so bad. And then my hands crack. It's really dry here. Then my dog likes to lick my hand when I feed him and that gets in there and it gets infected. Yike. So you really need skin cream. I do. Okay. So if I understand you right, you need skin cream because you've tried everything. You've got a skin condition. You love your dog. Your dog loves you. That's causing a problem. One of the ways to solve it is this skin cream? Yeah. Okay. How big a tub do you want?
Yeah.
Totally different than, and that was me being a jerk, but you know, like,
yeah,
it's just a normal conversation, but I have to train my people on our values, on my customers, what matters to my customers, the only thing that matters. That's it.
So it sounds like you have to first spend a good amount of time getting clear on who your customer is, what their needs are, so that you have that kind of conversational level of insight so that you can have a natural conversation. Because for example, the digital marketing agency I'm a part of, it's a service that applies to any business that exists. And so a lot of times we can be in that, fall into that trap of, well, this is for everybody.
It's
because it's,
but nobody wants to hear that.
So everybody wants a website or needs a website or whatever, but that makes it difficult on the, you know, targeting, scripting, that side of things, because it's like, well, how can you optimize for a specific audience if you're trying to reach everybody? Yeah.
But you see, and you know, we can talk about websites as an example. I wouldn't come in talking about websites. I would come in talking about solutions, right? Are you trying to reach your customers? Mm-hmm. Do your customers understand what you do? And do you understand your customers? How do you reach them if they want to research you late at night or on the fly without talking to you? You know, all of the business things that drive a business decision. And on the consumer side, we can do very similar things. But I just simply can't overstate understanding your customers' needs. And that's where you have to get really crafty. Facebook groups are a great place. Go find where your customers, your perfect customer, whether you have them or not, Therese, right? Doesn't matter whether you've got customers or not. Go look on a Facebook group that already serves your customer and really pay attention to what frustrates people or what they found and they were very excited by, right? That's the first thing. The second thing is go to Amazon and go look at a book that was written for your perfect customer. Go look at the comments section.
That's
good. Comment section is going to say, I didn't like this book. It didn't do X, Y, or Z. You're like, huh, X, Y, and Z sound pretty important to me. Guess what my product or service is now going to do?
Right.
The data has, we have never had better and easier access to data than now. And if you or I ignore it, it's on us.
I love that one. Looking at the comments of something in that, the interest of your target customer.
Yeah. I mean, you got to put a wacko filter on that because,
right,
you know, it's Facebook.
Yeah.
You need a wacko filter. But you get the point, right? If 99% of the people say this, then that's important. How do I serve that need? And if I can't, don't lie. Do not lie.
Mm-hmm.
Ever. But find a way that you either serve it or solve it, or adjust your product or service so that it does serve it or solve it.
Right. Okay. No, that's some great insights. I'm going to be marinating on a few of those and try some of those myself.
Good.
All right. Well, let's go. Let's move on to the six franchises that grew to over 200 around the world. What was that business and how did that get started?
Yeah. Thank it's it seems so long ago now. I mean, it wasn't because I sold it a couple of years ago before I started the two podcasts that I have now. But I, because when I left the corporate world, right? So I was in telecom and then I went and sold money for a while. Then I went back to another telephone company. And to be honest, I just did that to get the options before they went public. You know, I wasn't really passionate about selling telecom services. But then I bought a franchise from somebody else for business coaching. So I learned how to become a business coach in the year 2000. Therese, that's the turn of the century. I'm old, dude. Been around for a while. When I was a business coach, the word business and coach were not used in a sentence together.
Yeah. And that's right before the dot-com bubble happened.
Right. And remember, the mail order pharmacy was right there, was during that dot-com bubble.
Oh, okay.
And we never got caught up in it because we never actually referred to ourselves as a website. We were a mail order pharmacy. That little change in mindset didn't allow us to get sucked into the dot-com bubble and start to do dumb things. It's a business. Run it like a business. Don't get head faked by things that don't exist, right?
So anyways, the website was performing its function as just part of your marketing.
Yeah.
Instead of it being, hey, we're this new hot startup that's based on the web or whatever.
Yeah. No, we had a real solid business behind it.
Yeah.
And I should say that we had a very clear CTA. I know you know what this is, but call to action.
Mm-hmm.
Our call to action was one thing. That 1-800 number. Phone this number.
Okay.
That was it. I mean, eventually we had a form where people could contact us if they didn't want to talk. But really, the call to action, the clear call to action, which I firmly believe in, one simple call to action that everything drives through was that.
Yeah. So that's why the phone was ringing off the hook.
It was going crazy. And sorry, now I'm off from your question. So anyways, I learned to become a business coach by actually buying a franchise from another coaching organization. But there's kind of overlapping lines here. I don't know if people can see is the screen, but I left corporate, bought that franchise. During the term of that franchise, I started the pharmacy and it grew and I sold it. At that time, the franchise had terminated, it had lapsed. I only had a 5-year franchise term. So that had come and gone. And then I found out that Brian Tracy had started his own business coaching franchise and he was looking for somebody to take it over. So a partner and I bought it from him and he had 6 franchisees. Now, something else I didn't tell you is that because I have a background from sales, I also had a background in training, which goes hand in hand with professional business coaches. So when I was at the first franchise, I was actually training business coaches there. So they were flying me to New Zealand, Australia, obviously the United States, up to Canada to train other franchisees. So I was already experienced in that. So buying the business from Brian Tracy and revamping that was what I had already known how to do. So he had 6 franchisees. We had to get them successful. Success as a business coach means one thing: get success for your clients. Doesn't mean success for yourself. You get your clients successful, all else takes care of itself. And so that's how we started. That was always the premise of that franchise. That's why we grew it to over 200 units around the world.
Okay. So that was, sounds like, as long as you did great customer service, delivered your service really well, that's what was the core of that growth driver.
Yeah.
Okay.
There you're selling IP, you're selling intellectual property services, right? You're not selling anything tangible. You're selling a system. You're selling a new mindset. And so that takes a slightly different angle on the same thing. Be very curious about what people need and care about the solution and they will work with you.
So how did the approach to a new customer for that franchise business look? Or like, there's two kind of questions here, like a new customer for that franchise, like how would you approach them and close them? And then like the decision to open up a new franchise, like what did that look like?
Two very different things. Like, so how do we sell somebody a franchise if they qualify? And then how does a franchisee sell a customer?
Right.
And maybe what I'll do, if you don't mind, let me start with how do you find and bring a customer on as a business coach? Because there's lots of coaches who are listening, probably more than franchisors. So, and there's lots of different types of business or lots of different types of coaches out there now, not just business coaches, but lots of different kinds. One of the things I've always found is we have to get out of our own head. What I think is value to the client is not what the client thinks is value. So quite often in a dinner conversation, or if I'm at a barbecue and somebody's, oh, you're a business coach, you show people how to make money. or you take failing businesses and you turn them around. I'm like, kinda. So first, I don't work with failing businesses. I only work with successful businesses that want to get to the next level. But to get to the next level, they just can't see over the hill. So I show them what that looks like. That's our simple system, right?
Okay.
You have to find out what the customer needs. And if you are the solution, let them know that. But it comes from asking a ton of open-ended questions and really understanding their place.
Can you give an example of what one of those questions might be on a like intro, first discovery, sales call, first meeting, first conversation?
Yeah. The very first one is, have you ever talked to a business coach before?
Okay.
Just an open-ended question. Let's get us started, right? And so if you could wave a magic wand and you could change anything in this business, anything you wanted, what would those be? Maybe give me three. What would be three big things you wanted? Time and money or no object? What would they be? And then just start writing notes. They probably won't stop talking for 20 minutes. And let them talk. Give them the right and the respect to get it all out of their head, because you're the only person they can talk to.
So can you say that second question again?
Yeah. If you had unlimited time and money, if you could change anything you want in your business, what would it be?
Gotcha.
Give me three things you would change in the business. Okay. Gotcha. I tell you the worst answer I ever got to that.
What's that?
I knew I was in front of the wrong prospect. She said, I would change the carpets. I'm like, oh no, I'm in the wrong meeting. What am I doing here? I hadn't qualified properly, right? It's on me.
You're like, well, there's a carpet store down the street.
Yeah, like that's what you would change in this business? I'm talking like high level. What do we have to do? She's like, I would change the carpets. And I just thought, how do I get out of this? I'm in the wrong meeting, man. It's my fault, but you know.
So the goal behind that open-ended question is you're trying to discover their goals and pain points. Okay. Yeah,
what are their pain points? You might think it's money, but it might be time.
Right.
And usually both money and time and frustration come down to family. At the root cause of all of this is family. In so many different flavors that even I can't count them. The nuances of family, of not being home, of missing your daughter's softball practice when she really wanted you there, or being the mom or dad who was at the practice but on their phone looking down the whole time, not watching her when she made the great catch, the great play. That sucks. None of us signed up for that. Your kid deserves better. So, and I wouldn't say that to them, but they know that. And they're talking to me because something's got to change, man. What do I change? And there's an order of operations for the change, which I know inside and out, but it depends on what they need first. But I have to listen. You know, there's so many different things. There's a guy that I was asking that same question to. And I'm like, well, why do you want more sales? And it sounds dumb. Like, it's the dumbest question somebody got. Why do you want more money?
Right.
Right? Why do you want more money? But I gave him time to answer that question and long conversation. But here's what it came down to. His mom had dementia and had to go in a home. She was in a room with three other ladies. So a quad, you know, a four setup. And one of the other women was up all night yelling and screaming, and his mom couldn't sleep. Mm. His dad had left the scene years ago. He was basically raised by his mother and just, you know, pretty emotional. He's like, my mom deserves better. I got to get this business so I can put her in a private room. And by the way, we did.
That's cool. But
do you want to know if that guy's driven? That guy, what's going to stop him taking care of his mom?
Yeah.
But you have to give him a chance to talk about it.
So how much of that first conversation is just that open-ended listening? Like, is there that, there's a point where you transition to pitching the service, like get into the little, like, how would you coach someone who you were training as one of your salespeople?
Listening is the thing.
Okay.
You know, the 80-20 rule.
Yeah.
I've got to listen more than I talk, or, you know, God gave us two ears and one mouth and we should use them in proportion. So obviously I have scripts there. I'm a big fan of scripts. The scripts are not word by word scripts. They're more themes. Like, we have to explore this theme and this theme and this theme. And those always remain the same, but I'm going to ask the question, then let the person answer. And then we're going to have an intelligent conversation about how those things interact. And at some point I'm going to say, should we talk about the solutions? Do you want to hear how coaching works? It's even better if they ask. Now, let me back up by saying, when we talk about professional services, it is not a one-call close. Is that a language you guys are familiar with on the show?
One-call like format? I don't think we've talked about that specifically.
Yeah. So, for instance, at the pharmacy, somebody calls, we're going for the sale. They don't need a lot of time. It's transactional.
And it's inbound.
Yeah, like lead. If you run a dog walking service or a doggy daycare, they call, they want to know if you've got capacity, availability, what does it look like? It's a close or it's not a close. Right. Intellectual property services, where you're selling accounting, finance, legal, consulting, any of those types of things, I like to follow a two-call close format. And so the first call is short. It's a qualifying call. Just very simply, I'll say it's 30 minutes. It changes depending on the industry, but the first call is just 30 minutes. It's a discovery call. They have to get to know and trust me, and I have to figure out if they're a qualified candidate for this at all. Do we have all decision makers present? Those rules never go away. I'm not going to waste an entire hour if they can't get the other decision maker on the phone, right? If all decision makers are not there, we're not having the meeting, right? You must have all decision makers there to make a decision.
On the discovery call or that second call?
I want them on the discovery. And if they're not there, okay, Now it's my job to get them on the second call, which is very hard to do, but you got to do it other than wasting the time, right?
So you'd rather not even have the meeting until...
Or we don't have it. Yeah.
That decision maker can make that
meeting. That's right. We don't have it until. Yeah. That is that. If you ask me what's the hard and fast rule about sales, there's a bunch of them, but one of them is you can only present your solution when all decision makers are present. And when they all completely understand what we're talking about. Wow. They can't just cruise in at the last minute and go, yeah, tell me what you guys were talking about.
I've been there.
Right? So have I. It's embarrassing.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. It doesn't work. It's so better to cut it off.
Okay. I was going to say that I know that specific little behavior can be tough because you can feel like a pressure when you're trying to get sales for your business, like a time pressure. Like we got to, keep the pace of this thing moving forward. So maybe you'll accept that earlier meeting without all the decision makers just because you want to keep showing progress or whatever. But you're saying it'd be better to do whatever you have to do, wait as long as you have to do to get all the decision makers in the meeting.
That's right. They have to be there. It simply can't happen. It simply can't.
I'm going to have to chew on that one a little while.
Yeah. That could be the big takeaway from this meeting. Now, there's people listening are like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. We never get both decision makers there.
Right.
Well,
right.
I know exactly how this is going to sound, but I will sell circles around you the rest of your life. If you believe that, you will work harder than you need to get all decision makers there, figure out how to do it respectfully and with care. And you'll be able to, you'll have an unstoppable business, but you have to have, you can't do it without the decision makers.
So does that put more pressure on the prospecting and qualifying time to where you actually figure out who the decision makers are before you even talk to anybody?
That's such a great point. Such a great point. Right now, when we're talking about corporate, like big, we sometimes have to work our way up. You got to swim like a salmon upstream. So there's some tactic there. Right. So I'm not taking that into account, but we are still getting to the decision maker. If you're dealing with purchasers, you're in purgatory. You've got to get out of that loop. Purchasers don't care. They're just reducing you to a commodity. But I'm talking about where we have like you sell websites and different digital media services.
Yeah.
We should be able to get to the decision maker of a company up to, let's say, $8 or $10 million easily.
Yeah.
But we got to work it. And we have to have a reason. Why do we need the president of an $8 million company in this meeting? My answer is, are you kidding me? I'm surprised we got this far. First of all, you shouldn't be wasting your time unless this is at the level of that kind of decision. And second, the solutions I'm talking about are going to ripple through the entire company. The only person who knows where all those ripples are going to land is the president. I can't do this meeting. I can't do the meeting unless he's here or she's here. Can't do it.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to get mad. Somebody's going to get mad at me, and I don't want that. So when can Jenny be here? When can George be here?
Yeah.
Stop right there. That has to happen.
Interesting. Yeah, this is kind of new information from my perspective. I've heard the emphasis on you know, meeting with decision makers, like that's ideal. But I haven't heard somebody say, I'm just not meeting with anybody unless they're a decision maker. So yeah, that's
and I get caught. I get caught every once in a while. The decision maker's not there, but it's not going to happen. And so now there's a whole other loop that I've got to get into. How do we get the decision makers there? But again, if they're not there, that's pretty much a dead deal.
Really? If they're not in that first meeting?
Yeah. Well, they can not be in the first meeting, but we're not going to have the second meeting. So thank you for that point. What happens if they're not in the first half hour meeting? My only job is to sell the second 30-minute meeting with all decision makers present. And then we can go to the third meeting, which is the full, a 1 hour presentation, a 1 hour meeting. It's still the two call close format, but we had a fail on the first call where we didn't have all decision makers present.
Because you're looking at it as a official call is where the decision makers are there. That counts as that first call, whenever the first call is that they're present.
If they are not there, you are visiting. You're not selling nothing. You're not. So you're visiting.
Even if you talk to the gatekeeper in that first meeting, you would still want to do a discovery style in that second meeting where you're talking to the decision maker.
Yeah, you got to get the decision maker there. So can I give you a book suggestion? It's an old book, but it doesn't matter. It's fantastic. It's called Selling to Veto, and it's written by Tony Perinello.
Okay.
He's Italian, but he's not related to me. Veto stands, it's an acronym, V-I-T-O, very important top officer. Now, in some cases, it's going to be too much gun for the bear. I don't know what people are selling here. We all come at this entrepreneurialism our own way. Maybe they're selling hand creams and maybe they're selling heavy equipment, whatever. Sales is about continuous study. It really is an art. It's not just randomness and it's not just talking. I'm playing chess while everybody else is playing checkers. I need to know these inside tracks. That book, Selling to Veto, will explain who the decision maker is, who the influencer is. And we've got names for them, by the way. The influencer's name is Seymour. They just want to see more. It doesn't matter, right? Then you got Mr. How much is it? Say that. How much is it? The only thing that person knows is to ask is how much is it? Because they don't see the value. The decision maker sees all the decisions and the impact of those decisions. The decision maker is the one who says, I understand this is more expensive and this is the feature set or the service that we need. That's why we're doing it. Can I add one more thing?
Please do.
Okay. Sorry, man. You got to cut me off here. But the decision maker is the only person who can say yes. They have all the power in the world to say yes. Everybody else in that organization has only one power, and that is to say no. They can only say no. I'm not talking to that person.
Gotcha. And depending on the structure of a company, it may not necessarily be the CEO, because somebody, like in some cases, we'll talk to a marketing director.
VP, you're selling to a department.
Or they're managing a budget or whatever, and they can hire agencies or whatever.
Yeah.
But that would be accounted as the decision maker in that situation if they're the ones. Yeah. I got you.
Right. Yeah. There's always a decision maker, but you need to know who that decision maker is. If you tell me the decision maker is somebody in an administrative position. I'm not knocking anybody in an admin position. You know, no, this person works up front. They take all the phone calls. They know what the need is. Yeah. They're making all the decisions. I'm like, you're wasting all the time. You go ahead and you run after that all you want. You're not making a sale, buddy. You're visiting. You're not selling. I sound mean. I've just been tested by fire, man. There was a point in time when I lived on barbecue sauce sandwiches because I wasn't picking up what I'm putting down right now.
Yeah.
You know?
So where do you think along your career did some of this stuff really crystallize? Maybe it's hard to say a certain point, but was there like a transition point where you're like, okay, this is how the proper way to do things where you kind of turned?
It started in Sprint. I mean, we really got trained like gladiators.
Okay.
So we were in, you take any city that we were in a big city and the city was split into four quarters. And then the downtown, which is obviously the most dense place, was also split into four quarters. So you had territory A, B, C, or D. And that was your territory you could sell in. That was it. The borders were the borders. But wait, there were three other guys in that territory with you. And you had a number to meet monthly. And if you didn't, you might get away with 1 or 2 months of not hitting your number, but 3 months and you're gone. You're just gone.
So they purposely would put multiple people in the same area to keep it competitive.
Maximum capacity, maximum. And like I said, it was a high testosterone frat house, right? And we were still trained to sell ethically and professionally. That's where I learned about selling to Vito. That's where I originally was introduced to Brian Tracy, who would one day become my business partner. Talk about crazy talk. Who would think that? Who would ever think? I never dreamed it. But there's a discipline. There's a science to selling. And again, you can go through all that. Maybe you never want to. As long as you're curious and you care, you act ethically, and you're really trying to help people, you'll be able to sell. But there's a whole science behind it.
So the Selling to Vito, are there any other books you might recommend? I know you have, so you have a list of a little stack of books behind you, a row of books.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. So I'll tell you, immediately in my mind, I was going to tell you all the books that I have behind me. But I think what's more important, if I follow my own advice, is I would ask everybody listening is, who's your ideal client? If your perfect customer is really into horses or really into dogs or really into, I don't know, toothbrushes, like, I don't know, read what they read. Like, if you sell to dentists, read what they care about reading. And get in their head. Try to join forums where they're talking. You don't have to talk, just listen. Learn. What are their pain points? So what's the pain point in the equestrian industry? What's the pain point in heavy equipment? What's the pain point for me? You know, I deal with contractors, people that own construction and contracting companies. Their pains are very interesting to me because I need to be the person that solves that pain. So if you have the world's greatest baking pan, does it matter if you don't understand why people are using it? What if you find out that people are using it for making Jell-O molds? And you just keep saying, it's a baking pan, it's a baking pan. But everybody who's really into Jell-O, I'm making this stuff up, by the way. But everybody who's really into Jell-O is like, this is the greatest thing that ever happened to the world of Jell-O. But you keep going, it's a baking pan, it's a baking pan. You're just missing so much opportunity.
So get to know your target customer.
Get in their head.
The ongoing theme on our podcast here has been, it seems like the recurring pattern is, clearly define that target customer and then connect with them as much and as deeply as possible.
Yeah.
Because we've had some entrepreneurs say that, you know, the business would be born just from talking about an idea for a business that could solve some of their problems, just purely from conversation, talking to people they wanted to serve.
Yeah.
And the business was the first customer just from brainstorming with people. And so that just reinforces, I think, what we've heard repeatedly is defining that target customer and connecting with them seems to be the critical piece, kind of that core of everything to do with getting that first customer.
Yeah. And I've got to get better at it too, by the way. Like that's still in my head. How do we get better?
Yeah.
How do we get better? You know, we got hacked the other day, Paris.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. And we got hacked kind of internally. I fired a subcontractor and then they came back in through an admin password and sent an email to my entire database. Super classy.
Mm.
Do you know what I got back as feedback from our audience? I could tell it wasn't you, Dom. It didn't sound right, right? The email didn't sound right. And they could tell it wasn't me.
Right.
Now, I'm telling you, I still have to get better at understanding the core driving need of my audience, but I love my audience. And what was so cool for me is they said, that didn't sound like you.
It's powerful. So you've communicated so much and so deeply with them that they recognize you, even through
digital format. Even after I got hacked. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not even a hack. It was kind of a social engineering hack, right? Crazy.
Yeah. No, that's powerful stuff. And thanks again for spending time with us today. I think this is a good place to end it. You've shared some just pure gold when it comes to sales advice and finding those first customers. What's your current business that you're running, and what's the current kind of target customer you're going after, just in case anybody who might be in your target audience is listening
to this. So the, you know, as I mentioned before, I work exclusively with construction and contracting business owners. And so I've got two podcasts. One of them is called Profit Tool Belt. I'm wearing that hat today.
Okay.
The other one, Priest, Do Not Drink Your Coffee Right Now.
Uh-oh.
I'll tell you the title of the other podcast. And when I tell you the title, I want to see if you can guess who the audience is.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Here's what it's called. Cabinet Maker Profit System.
Cabinet makers.
Yep. Greatest audience, you nicest people you
okay.
have ever met. So they do cabinetry. They do architectural millwork. They do closets. They also do furniture. And you're like, Rubino, are you kidding me? You're laughing. I could see it. And you know what? Nicest. Paris, I just came back from speaking at an Amish business conference.
Nice.
Because of, I love my audience, but I also respect where they come in from, where they're at.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard for the Amish to bring in an outsider.
Hmm.
I have to have shown that I respect the boundaries of their culture and the way of approaching things, and that I can do work and find results within that boundary. That's inside of the industry of cabinetry. That's not the whole industry of cabinetry.
Right.
So again, understanding your ideal audience, that's what I'm trying to do. So I've got, if you're in construction or contracting, if you take big pieces of wood and then you cut them into little pieces of wood and you put them together into pretty pieces of wood, or, you know, steel or whatever, or tiles, I'm your guy. If you build houses, renos, that's who I serve. Yeah.
Awesome. All right. We're going to put links to all of your businesses and the different things we've mentioned in the show notes. But thanks again. This has been great. It's really nice meeting you, and look forward to talking to you more.
Thanks.
Appreciate you being here. Thanks.